Hi, I'm Harriet Tramer, and I hope you will join me every other Tuesday afternoon at this time when I host Reaching for the Gold. Today's guests are both working in their own ways to ensure that aging people receive the help they not only need but deserve. Bob Lynn Scott is Deputy Director of the LBGT Aging Project, which helps people who lead alternative lifestyles move through their latter years. Carolee Warren has written a book entitled, But Mama, How Come Grandpa Gets to Put His Feet Up on the Couch and I Don't? It is designed to help young people come to understand caregiving and the role they might play in this process. Carolee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Harriet.
Carolee, how did you happen to write this book? I understand it's a children's book to help children understand caregiving. How did you happen to write that?
I actually wrote the book because I lived it. I wrote it as therapy to myself. We've been taking care of my father-in-law for 4.5 years. And there are times when it gets to be a little challenging, even though it's very rewarding. And I just had a very frustrating day one day. I'm a middle school principal, so as you can imagine, that job can be a little challenging, even though it is also rewarding. And one day when I came home, there was quite a mess in the house, and I just thought about all the mud that was all over the floor and how those feet had gone to the gazebo to relax. And I just realized that those feet had also gone to the steel mill for 40 years to earn a living to take care of my husband when he was a young child. And I just worked through the anger, and I just started writing down thoughts along that line.
Had you ever previously written a book or done much writing other than professionally for your job?
No, I had written a couple magazine articles a while back for a Christian magazine, but I hadn't written anything along the line of a book.
Mm-hmm. What is unique about this book? In other words, there is so much written about caregiving and aging and memory impairment. It could fill 20 bookshelves. Give yourself a little pass here. What is unusual about this book?
I've heard it described as a simple book with a powerful message. I think it's very honest. I don't think it sugarcoats the challenges. But more importantly than that, I do believe it teaches the values that we would hope to teach our children. And there is enough humor in it to help us all go through this with a little bit lighter heart. And it hits a universal nerve. There are so many people who are experiencing caregiving. And we know that will continue to be the case. So I think there are a lot of people who relate to it.
What are you trying to teach children might be the greatest reward of caregiving? We know it's challenging. That's obvious.
True.
What are you trying to teach them might be the greatest reward? What do they have to gain from it?
Well, the reward needs to be in and of itself of doing the right thing. And I hope that we can try to teach our children that, whether we're here at school or at home as parents, that we do the right thing, and that is its own reward. And we teach people to be kind to one another and to show respect and tolerance. And whether we agree with what they have to say, we have a choice. One of our quotes that we say here at middle school every morning is, you have the power to make someone's day a little better or a little worse. Use that power wisely. It's a powerful gift for all of us to have the opportunity to make somebody's day a little bit better. And that's what I hope we can do with this book, to just try to encourage people to move in that direction.
Okay, I'm going to ask a question that people think in the back of their head, but they don't necessarily want to ask. What happens if this grandparent was not a particularly nice person? In other words, hey, here's grandma, here's grandpa. They don't remember things. This is wrong, that's wrong. Hey, they were never a nice person to begin with. What's going on here I should deal with?
That's a very fair question, Harriet. And in my case, I am completely fortunate. My father-in-law is just the nicest man you'll ever meet. Granted, if you're dealing with an older person who becomes very angry and combative, that's a whole new set of challenges that I am not faced with. There are certainly times where there are no choices left but to have someone under 24/7 care in a facility. My mother-in-law actually had Alzheimer's severely and was at the point where she didn't know her husband, very much like the movie The Notebook, and she would fight against them, and she would kick him. It would be very hurtful. We had to move her away from him. So in her case, we had to give her 24/7 care at a great home where we knew she was protected. Otherwise, she would run out into the street in the middle of the winter. So there are times where people have to make that hard choice.
Mm-hmm. Or what happens when you have two siblings and one older person who needs care, or three siblings, only one of the siblings is willing to do anything. Might the children say, hey, wait a minute.
Well,
maybe you're willing to do something, but why should I? Why should I do anything more than my cousins? How would you respond to something like that?
Well, and again, that's a very fair question. And generally speaking, from the experiences I have had speaking with people, it almost always seems to work out where the majority of the work falls on one of the siblings. A lot of times, it's just the logistics of the matter. For example, in our case, my husband has two brothers, one who is in Virginia and another one in Illinois, and it made a lot more sense for Grandpa to come stay with us where it was close to the facility that his wife was in. So oftentimes there are those reasons, and I know it's hard, but I think the sibling that does have the parent has to not let your mind travel down that road and begin to feel mistreated or unfair. And again, going back to what I said earlier, that doing the right thing is its own reward, and I think we have to stay focused on that and know that we answer for ourselves and not the people around us.
That's a very valuable lesson, I would think, not an easy one to learn.
Sure.
Do you think this book can teach children some important lessons about respect, just not about caregiving, respect in general? Does it teach them some important lessons about the dignity of hard work? That message seems to come clear in this excerpt, but Mama, which you touched on before, but Mama, how come Grandpa gets to put his feet up on the couch and I don't? Because, Bronson, those are the feet that took Grandpa to the work at the steel mill every day for 40 years, so your daddy would never go hungry. Do you think caregiving can be a lesson not only in caregiving, but in respect for the hard work this person put in?
Definitely. Any of those positive traits carry over. We can transfer those traits to many situations. And how we learn to treat one group of people is often how we treat another group of people. So most definitely, I think if we can help our children understand the value of treating our elderly people with respect, we can also help them learn to treat people with other disabilities with respect and just people in general.
Mm-hmm. Now, what you say and your message is very powerful and very beautiful.
Thank
what
you.
What makes you think that this book, in fact, is imparting that message? Have you had people read it and they seem to understand better? Have you had comments on it? What makes you, in fact, think it is imparting these messages? They're very strong messages, but what makes you think this is getting to the point?
I have had a lot of positive feedback. Most anyone who has bought the book has taken the time to tell me, those in my immediate circle, that it really did hit home and it really was very helpful. They seem to hear that message loud and clear, and the books that have been sold to my friends and families and each network that keeps reaching out, we keep getting that same message back, that the book really did teach them to care for others and to respect the elderly and to just hang in there and do the best they could to make the best of a tough situation.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, can you give a passage from the book or summarize a paragraph or a chapter that you think allows it to really deliver that message. Give me some real high points from your book.
Well, I think just the mother's response continuously saying, because Bronson, that is the neck that your dad held on to when he was a little boy. I think each part of that portion of the page is stressing that there was a very positive correlation to the challenge. And we make that choice to focus on the positive or the negative. That's an individual choice. And just the fact that Mama continues to say, because Bronson, there's always a reason, there's always an answer to come back with why we do what we do or why we tolerate what we do.
In other words, you're saying not, don't ask questions, that's just the way it is. You explain, and you think that approach works better?
Well, I do, as you'll see in the book, Mama does come back with an answer each time. For one example, why does Grandpa get to interrupt and talk all the time and I have to wait my turn? We definitely teach our children to wait, to be polite. And then Mama's response, because Bronson, that is the voice that once sang lullabies to your daddy. We're just trying to be reminded throughout the book that maybe Grandpa isn't thinking as clearly now as he did when he had better social skills. But there was a time when he had those social skills. Mm-hmm. And he would have wanted you to have those same social skills.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, in this program and in life, we talk about aging. And aging really is just part of life. Everybody is aging. You are a middle school principal. I imagine I'm correct. Your students are probably something between 11 and 14, right in there.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yes.
They're aging. Everybody's aging. Do you think their aging is very different than the aging you and members of your generation experienced when you were growing up? Do you think they're aging into a different world and have to age earlier?
I do. I do think there are some challenges that this generation has that mine did not have. Just the fact that we know there are so many single parents trying to raise their children, just the very nature of the job being done by one person compared to two makes it twice the challenge. If you had the two parents to provide the living, to provide the support, obviously the load is shared. So that is a greater challenge just in and of itself. Not that the job can't be done extremely well, but it's harder for each person. We have fantastic students who have really tough home situations, but somehow they find the strength and the resolve to rise above that and to stay focused. But I do think our kids today are dealing with more adult problems than they did in my generation.
I have absolutely nothing else. I know nothing about your school or its area, but unemployment is so broad
Sure.
that it is affecting everybody. That is an adult problem. These children are dealing with it. My generation rarely had to.
Right. That's also tough. And just the other day, thinking back a little more when you ask about the book, and the response, I was really fortunate. On Saturday, I was able to go on the Lisa Gibbons Care Connection walk and actually met her, and she was very gracious to become a part of our video. I'm speaking at her symposium in November, and she stressed all the attributes that you asked me about. Did I think the book was teaching? And she said definitely those were the things that she saw in the book and that she wanted. She enjoyed it so much because as we get older, she really sees that our kids do have greater challenges. And so using a book as a tool to help them remember and to stay focused, we hope is a positive way.
Mm-hmm. Now, another way that children are having to grow up faster now is they have to keep up with technology.
Mm-hmm.
Does the
but they can do that. the kids can do that. When we get in a jam as adults, we go to our kids, and they can keep up with the technology. And they are great teachers. They love to help us adults. They're
okay.
doing a fine job.
Now, if you have a, I'm just putting in these figures, you have a 14-year-old child, you have, we'll say, a 45-year-old mother, and a 80-year-old grandmother who may be having some dementia. Well, she is unlikely to be working on computers, although some people in their 80s do.
True.
Doesn't that create more of a bridge? Doesn't that make it harder for children to understand, okay, how can I communicate with this person? I text my friends 15 times a day, each one of them. Mm-hmm. We don't really sit and talk that much. What's going on here? I can't text this person. What do I say? Doesn't that create a real gap that's hard to bridge, the technology gap?
Well, it can, but it does not have to. Again, I think that goes back to how much you value a person. Sometimes we have to step into another person's world a little bit more out of our element, only because we do care. And certainly technology is not going to be as important to someone in their 80s as someone in their 14 most of the time. But there are a lot of older people who do have cell phones, and their grandchildren have taught them how to receive text messages, and it's been very rewarding for them. But if a child is taught to love his grandparents or her grandparents, it's not asking a lot for them to make a phone call or to stop by to visit. I do believe many of them are still very happy to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A review of your book by Dr. Lauren Harding mm-hmm. praises it as being a perfect book for caregivers and loved ones of Alzheimer's patients. It reminds us to remember and respect the life this person has lived before it was taken away. Is that necessarily the most appropriate way to look at Alzheimer's or any form of memory impairment, that it takes their life away?
I'm sure where she was going with that was that the current personality with the social skills, that's the part that is taken away. The life itself is not taken away, obviously, and I've tried to learn to look at it as a more childlike, innocent stage, because there is also often the reversion back to childhood. And I do believe that that is actually where she was coming from on it, the life that we knew that person had with those social skills. Many times that is no longer. But there is also a sweetness sometimes, and sometimes not. But there is definitely a reversion back to childhood.
There has been much written about how people with memory impairment can become much more creative than they ever were, can look at a picture and be right on and analyzing it and discussing it, can do poems, can do music, can do all kinds of things, even if they had no prior experience in this. Does your book or in dealing with young people, do you ever discuss any of that? Yeah, this person isn't doing what they once did, but maybe they're doing some things they couldn't do or just never did do.
True, and I think that's a great opportunity to redefine yourself. I know people who have gone back to college late in life, people who have taken up skydiving. I think we need to look at each stage of life as a valuable opportunity to redefine ourselves. I don't think we ever need to look at life and say, I'm too old to do this, or this isn't the time. I was 49 before I received my bachelor's degree. I could have told myself I was too old to continue college, but I think the trend now is becoming more popular for society to accept the fact that older people still have a lot to offer. You see older people in the Olympics far more than we would have ever expected in the past, and I think it's wonderful. Each stage of life is a great opportunity to learn something new.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it happening more frequently.
Mm-hmm. How would you respond? Because I'm sure you have received this comment. How would you respond to people who say, hey, wait a minute, that's a wonderful message, but our whole culture is not attuned to caregiving, to being sensitive to someone who might not be right with it every 5 minutes. Our culture is attuned to youth, to productivity, to moving at a fast pace, to taking care of yourself, and to blank, to be a bit crude. Isn't it very difficult to get that message across of caregiving?
Harriet, I think that is changing somewhat. I know our culture does not stand out as being one that has taught our children to deeply respect elder people. I really do feel optimistic that that is changing. I think it is partly changing because there is a big movement in the schools, for one example, to require community service in order to get a high school credit. I see more and more children, more and more students getting involved and reaching out to the community. Yesterday, I went on the Northwest Indiana Alzheimer's Walk, and I was impressed at how many children were there. Granted, most were brought by their parents, but I do see a lot of parents taking the time to teach their kids, reach out to your community, and part of that is reaching out to elderly people or those in need. So I'm feeling optimistic that our culture is changing in that direction in a positive way, both through the schools and through the home.
Now, one other point, and it's difficult to bring this up, but it's an honest question. Caregiving can be not only tiring on a physical level and an emotional level, but what about a financial level? In other words, if you're working and you have to pay somebody to come in and help with this person while you're not there, if you have to pay medical bills, if you have to pay this, if you have to pay that, it can be financially difficult.
Definitely.
In your book, do you ever discuss, well, maybe there's some things our family is going to have to go a little easy on because we're paying medical care for grandma or grandpa? I mean, that's a difficult thing.
That would have been a nice page to add, Harriet. You make a very valid point. That is definitely an added stress for a lot of people. I would suggest, too, that when the day comes for siblings to discuss what direction to head with parents, that at that moment it is decided upon how the finances will be handled. I know in many cases, as in ours, all three brothers were very confident that their father was not going to live more than 2 to 3 months. We're 4.5 years down the road now. Things are a little different than they were early on. So those discussions should happen initially. How will the finances be handled? And to work as carefully as possible to divide that load equally. And many parents have set aside a certain amount, but in today's world, medical bills eat that money in no time.
I mean, a certain amount, it can run into tens of thousands.
Oh, yes. Yes, the care for my mother-in-law in the nursing home evened out to roughly $280,000 in about 3 years. And that's a lot of money.
It is.
We were very fortunate. We loved the people who worked with her. And they had saved for that, and they provided that. But for people who would be in the situation who did not have that nest egg, that would be very challenging. There are a lot of great Medicaid facilities. My aunt was in one. And I have found, too, working with people more closely in nursing homes, I do see a lot of people who have a calling for that, where they definitely love their patients. My sister is a nurse at a nursing home. She loves her patients. I feel more positive about the whole system now that I've gone through it. I've seen a lot of positives in directions that I didn't expect to.
It's very difficult. Carol Lee, thanks for being a guest, and good luck with your book. And why don't we give you a little time here to put in a last plug why you think this book is something very significant and powerful.
Thank you, Harriet. I wrote the book as therapy to myself, And I know that when I would get discouraged and I would almost trip over the chair that Grandpa left out all the time, I just tried to think about him sitting there with his child on his lap, and it really did help me. I have heard from people who have bought it that it's been very moving, may have said it's brought them to tears, but it was well worth it, that it really helped them stay focused on loving the person they were caring for, which made it easier then for them to provide the care. So for anyone who does buy it, I really hope that message comes through to help you.
Carolee, thank you very much.
Thank you, Harriet. You have a great day.
Bob, welcome to the show. Tell us, how did you happen to become involved in the LBGT Aging Project, which deals specifically with people with various alternative lifestyles? How did you become involved?
I came involved because I had actually came in through working in a background in education and teaching, and I had been working as a Gay Straight Alliance advisor for many years. And one of the things that really was bothering me in that work was that there was just no intergenerational opportunities. And so much of gay history was not included in any textbooks at the time or anything like that. And I felt like the only opportunity for young people to learn about who they are and so much of the work that had been done in terms of the gay rights movement was from the elders, the people who had really paved the way, and there were not opportunities for any kind of connections. So I started creating these workshops that would bring together LGBT youth and LGBT elders. And at first I thought, oh, this is great. It's going to be a perfect idea. And then when it came down to running the first one, I thought, oh, my God, where do I find gay elders? And it just so happened in the Boston area. They had just within a few years it just started the LGBT Aging Project. So that's how I initially came in contact with them, and then I was really impressed with the work that they were doing. And then before I knew it, I was on board and working with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, why would there be a necessity for a special aging project for people who have different lifestyles? They're aging. They're human. Why would there be a need for something separate?
Right, well, that's a good question. Well, the situation is that there is so there is a real big disparity in terms of access to health care and support services for this particular population. And if you take a moment and think about what the world was like when this particular population was coming of age, it was not safe at all for them. If people found out their so-called secret that they were gay or lesbian or bisexual, they could stand to lose everything. They could lose their housing. They could lose their employment. If they had children, they could lose child custody. The services that we take for granted in terms of public safety, medical, none of that was there. There was a lot of police brutality for people who are known homosexuals. People could be committed against their will because it was a mental diagnosis up until 1972. So it was a really very challenging time, a very frightening time. So this population knew that their best defense mechanism was fly into the radar screen and go about their lives and don't draw attention, don't let people know this aspect. So there is a huge distrust of mainstream institutions because of the history in which they grew up in. And then the other part of this is the support systems that are absent. So many folks, one of the main support systems in your average senior's life is their spouse, and they're aging together. Aging on its own is challenging, but to be able to age with someone. And there was nothing that was supporting, you know, there was no such thing as gay marriage. And so there's nothing supporting long-term, healthy, same-sex relationships. So this population is aging alone at a much higher rate, 70% compared to the mainstream population. So they don't have a spouse there. They don't have children or grandchildren, which provide a tremendous amount of support for mainstream seniors. And then in terms of social needs, so many people, older adults, take for granted to be able to go to a community center, to go to a senior center, or to be able to participate in a faith community, and none of those had felt welcoming to LGBT older adults. So if you look at this, this distrust of mainstream institutions of police, medical support, and then not having, you know, a spouse, children, all these levels of support, what we're finding is these people who are aging alone, on their own, very isolated, and not feeling comfortable to reach out and accept mainstream, you know, elder services and support services. So in Massachusetts, for example, we have a really great elder service network to allow people to age in their own homes in place as long as humanly possible. So there is all these services that come in, home care, money management, protective services, meals on wheels, visiting nurses, all these things that come into the home and provide these services so people can age in their own home. But for gay and lesbian elders, there is such a huge fear that discrimination will raise its head again, and that home becomes the last closet, the last place where they can have pictures of themselves with a partner or maybe a guy was in drag at one point in his life and has a photograph of that up. I mean, there is a fear that if people come into the home and see these things, they'll be discriminated. And that fear is the carryover from this long history that they've gone through.
Now, you talked about programs that would bring together youth and older people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I need you to help me try to understand is you have older people from what you are describing who are frightened to make their identity known. And I'm
right.
sure that's understandable because they could be in physical danger.
Right.
On the other hand, with young people, you've got, and I've read, I don't know, I don't know this personally, but I've got reason to believe it happens. But you're old kids who say, hey, everyone says I'm a boy, but no, I'm a girl.
Yeah.
And I'm going to kindergarten in a skirt or a dress or whatever the blank. And
yeah.
Don't try to stop me because that's what I am. And you better call me Shirley instead of Carl. How
yeah,
can you bridge that gap? I mean, I may have made it a bit of an extreme. But how can
you
bridge that gap?
With a lot of patience and a lot of coaching on both parts. Especially, I feel like I spend a lot of time with some of the seniors that I work with on a regular basis, and really kind of helping them wrap their minds around that the world is changing. I run a meal site, which is a congregate meal site for gay and lesbian elders, and it's a federally funded site, and it's the first one that we know of that was in the United States. And so there's often been moments there where I am trying to do a little bit of kind of cultural education, and then I had a volunteer one time who was in there, and he brought his daughter, a little toddler, with him. She was about 2.5. And the guys kept asking him if his wife knew where he was, if his wife knew that he was at this place. And he kept saying, no, I'm not married to a woman. I'm not married to a woman. And then when they kind of got that he was gay and married to a man, they still kept wondering where the girl came from. And we had to sit everybody down, and he had to walk them through this whole business of how they did the artificial insemination and the surrogacy and all this stuff. And it was really, it was priceless to watch them see that the world was changing so quickly. But then there's been other moments that were more challenging than that. There was a queer youth theater group that was coming in, and we had this vision. We were going to do this combined intergenerational theater piece about people's life stories, and
mm-hmm.
the kids came in and they were so excited, and we all kind of mixed up, and we were kind of doing all the get to know you games. Everything was going really well until the word queer kept popping up, and the seniors were like, you know, oh, don't use that word, that's a bad word. And the kids were saying, we've reclaimed that. And the seniors kept saying, well, you shouldn't reclaim it, it's a bad word. And they just, pretty much everything came to a screeching halt because they couldn't agree on, you know, the use of words, how they were going to frame the whole experience. The kids are very, very, had very much reclaimed and embraced that word queer, and that identify this kind of whole new persona of defying kind of gender norms and everything like that, and they were just queer youth, and you know, it took some time, and that project never happened that year. We had since done other things, and the guys have gotten more used to that, but those are all examples of where you do kind of run into a little bit of a kind of a cultural gap there between the generations. But it's at the same time, the most rewarding moments of our year each year is when we do these intergenerational luncheons, and they are phenomenal. The stories are incredible. And what has really blown my mind is that these days there are more straight kids that come through, and they're so eager to hear the stories from gay elders. And when that first started happening, our gay seniors could not, that was another thing they couldn't wrap their mind. And why would these kids who are not even gay go out of their way to come hear them and meet them and hear their stories? And for whatever reason, it's been happening, and these luncheons have become more and more popular, and it's really a blessing to be a part of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you had people who, couples that had lived together, I'm just going to say 50 years, mm-hmm. now that they can get married, who got married? Have you experienced much of that?
Oh, yeah. A lot of them who had been together for so long got, as soon as it was possible to get married in Massachusetts, they did. They went right out and got married. But as I said earlier, it is a small minority, just because so few people are coupled. You know, the ones that have been in relationships, and I would say it's about maybe even less than 5% of the folks that I work with are in long-term couples.
Really?
But yeah. I did at one point. I was doing, just out of curiosity, because we kept talking about the numbers all the time. You know, 70% are aging, you know, alone compared to the mainstream population. I just did a head count of the guys that are at this meal program, and that particular meal program is primarily men, because it's during the daytime and a lot of the women are still working. I did just a count through my list, and it was 95% of the folks that were attending there, they were all single. So it was very surprising.
Now, one other question that just seems very obvious. You are based in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Boston or Massachusetts was the first state to allow gay marriage.
Correct.
I believe two New England states had gay partnerships before that, but Massachusetts mm-hmm. was the first to allow gay marriage.
Yes.
Do you have much of a disconnect between what you encounter in Massachusetts and when you go to other parts of the country where gay may not be that open? Do you catch much of a disconnect in that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like we live in a bubble sometimes. What's happening here is just unparalleled with anything else that's going on in the country. Yes, there's some pockets of things that are happening, you know, in New York, the movement at SAGE, which is Services and Advocacy for Gay and Lesbian Elders, and things that are happening out in the West Coast, in San Francisco. I mean, there are these healthy pockets of areas like that where there's a lot of support and social services and things like that for gay and lesbian elders. But for the most part, you know, I hear from other people who we just got a call recently from a woman in South Carolina who lost her longtime partner, and she was desperate to get some support she had heard, I don't know, online about we run these LGBT bereavement groups, and she's like, how can I find something like that near me? Well, there just wasn't anything. We spent such a long time searching, and we finally, the advice that I was giving her was like, you know, maybe it's best to move to an area where it's more welcoming to who you are, and there's more access to services that are there for you. So yeah, that is a big concern, because there are places where these things, where it is very welcoming, and there's so many things happening, and then, you know, maybe just a couple hours away, there's absolutely nothing. And out through the Midwest, I know it's very challenging for gay and lesbian older adults there, because they're back where folks were, you know, decades ago, where they're isolated, and they're afraid that people to find out that they're gay, and they don't want them to know the secrets and so forth. So I look forward to that movement to moving quicker throughout the country.
Well, we can't make stereotypes or paint real easy pictures of blue states and red states, because same-sex marriage is legal in both Iowa and Minnesota.
Right. Yeah.
You're talking about the Midwest.
Right. And I don't know those areas in terms of, you know, there's some folks that I've worked with that have just started to do some studies around folks that areas, states that have gay marriage, and what are other services available in those areas in terms of anti-discrimination laws and things like that, and, you know, LGBT community centers. So I don't know about those particular areas. If you know, and granted, they've got gay marriage, but are they doing a lot of active work to make sure that all generations are covered, from LGBT youth all the way up to LGBT older adults?
Mm-hmm. Now, what are some of the services that you provide?
Well, we are not actually a service delivery organization. Our main function, the LGBT Aging Project, is to go into the mainstream elder service network and do cultural competency training, so that all of their services and programs are more inclusive and welcoming to the needs of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender older adults. So we will work with that agency from top management all the way down to the direct service workers, and look at all levels in terms of their marketing, their internal policies, their advertising, everything, and really work so that they can look and make sure that they are, every aspect of their agency is has done this kind of cultural competency training and is inclusive of this population. Then once we finish that, that's only the first half of the work that we do, because if they finish that and they got a wonderful certificate that says, you know, you've completed this, it's what we call the Open Door Task Force. This agency has successfully completed its Open Door Task Force. They put a certificate in their boardroom and a rainbow sticker on the door. They'd still be waiting to this day for gay and lesbian elders to come and start accessing services, just because of that distrust of mainstream organizations that they're so used to, this population. But for the second half is that we continue working, and we do a whole level of outreach with that agency into their own community. So we'll get into the community, run programs, we'll do some kind of social programs, run focus groups, community conversations, really start getting folks together. And because there's just two of us in the LGBT Aging Project, myself and the director, Lisa Krinsky, and just by the very fact of being very public figures and being gay ourselves, it adds credibility. So I think that people feel a little bit safer knowing they're going to come to an event that is hosted by, you know, someone who's within the community and an agent, that the agency. So they come in a little timid, and they learn, and they meet the staff about the agency, and they will do needs assessment and find out what their living situation is, what their challenge is, what's their access to transportation, what's their medical concerns right now, and then what kind of programs would they be interested in, what kind of home care needs might they have. So in many cases, we've helped these agencies start some kind of program that allows some continuation and sustainability, that there's going to be something happening in that area on a regular basis that will provide ongoing contact and relationship building between the LGBT older adults and that elder service network. And the population of folks that are coming out for these things, of our seniors, are a younger group of seniors. These are folks that are in their 60s and 70s and really at this point don't need home care services, but at least they are now building a relationship that's going to last over years. So the meal site that I run is now we're just about into our 10th year now, and these folks are now, at this time now, many of them are ready for our home care services. They're ready to be able to have some more support to allow them, because they're not going to be able to get out and travel as much as they used to. So now that they know the agency, they know exactly who to go to when they need caregiving support or they need services in the home or visiting nurses. So I think that's the long-term benefits of this, is that you're creating this sustainable relationship between the agency and the LGBT older adults in that area.
Mm-hmm. One question that might help us bring out some information on human relations, human communication, how to handle things.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because they face such persecution. Older gay people or lesbian or bisexual often remain in the closet. We know that.
Right.
Now, I read these things. They have interviews. They had one in the New York Times with a couple, two men, lived together for like 60 years.
Yep.
And
yep.
They said, well, our families never knew. If somebody
right.
comes to you and says that, are you very tactful and say, well, they probably didn't, and that's for the better, because at that point there was just such prejudice that it's better they didn't know, it could have caused trouble? Or do you say, well, maybe they had a good inkling there?
Yeah.
How
well,
would you deal with something like that?
That's it's an interesting question, because I think I'll give you a couple examples, but we run a Thanksgiving meal every year. We run all holiday meals, but that Thanksgiving meal is so, we serve over 100 meals each Thanksgiving dinner, and it's the Thursday before Thanksgiving, and for most folks there, that's where they celebrate Thanksgiving. This population that we're working with now is predominantly estranged from their families of origin, and that's just because that there was no peace flag back in the, you know, in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. Families didn't understand what to do and what this meant, and there was a lot of confusion. And I think, and that worked both ways. I think that some of the seniors themselves had just thought, well, they don't get me, so they kind of pull away. And I think that there was just not a lot of communication, unfortunately, at that point. It's a completely different world when you're talking to people that are in their 30s and 40s and 50s. Their families are much more supportive and part of their lives. But it is our seniors that they just, you know, it's rare that they have a lot of connections with their siblings and things like that. I had an experience recently where someone came up to me and asked if he could have his name taken off our mailing list, and I said, "Well, of course you can, but do you think you're getting too many emails? Because we only send a newsletter once a month." I said, "Is that too much?" And he said, "Oh no, I love your newsletter." He said, "No, it's not that." He said, I'm 87 years old. I don't know how much time I have, and I have this fear that when I die, my family will go in and go into my email and find this and realize that and find out that I'm gay." And it just was like so sad to me that this fear is so pervasive that it's going to follow them beyond the grave. That he has to let go of something that he cares very much about because of this fear that someone may go in and find out later after he's passed away. So, you know, it is a reality. There are a lot of folks that have a really hard time with a simple task of when they do fill out registration forms for any of our programs or the community cafes, when we ask the what a name and number of someone to contact in case of emergency, they want to know, well, shall I put my landlord? Shall I put this person? People have asked if they could put my name down. So it's just, you know, unfortunately, a sad reality of not having a lot of support from their family of origin.
Now, I believe I'm correct. You are a baby boomer. Is that right?
Yeah, and the very end of the baby boom. Yeah, I was born in 64.
Okay. You have then definitely seen a lot of changes in your world.
Yeah.
How have you kept up with that? Are you very pleased to see the greater acceptance? Does it strike you as something you're not really secure with, you don't really trust, that you think may be taken away? How do you relate to that?
It's been just so amazing for me to see a huge change. And when I was coming out in high school and there were no GSAs or anything like that then, but all of that was just, was just beginning. And now to see, to have a sitting president talk so openly and stand in such support and solidarity of LGBT people all over the country. And it just blows my mind. And I think they're, you know, maybe I'm too much of an optimist, but I just, there's no way that we can ever, I feel like we can ever go backwards. People have now realized that there really is no difference between gay and straight people. And it's just been such an amazing experience seeing all these fantastic changes. And granted, yes, as I said before, I am in a bubble. I am in the state that has the first gay marriage, and so many things here it's very progressive and very liberal and very accepting. And so my only frustration is that if it happens here, why isn't it happening in all the states? And, I do realize that it just takes time.
What would you like to see happen in the next 5 years? What would you consider really remarkable progress?
Well, in my work,
in every state, or what would you consider remarkable progress?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that it would be fantastic if that was just universal, if it was just that ability was granted to everyone, you know, to have gay marriage in every state. But at the same time, you know, that would be really nice to have. But I think that there's some real pressing issues that are facing us right now here, and that is in terms of, you know, housing. And that's still a big fear for a lot of LGBT older adults. You know, where will they end up? What will happen to them if they have to go into an assisted living or a nursing home? And there are no kind of designated LGBT retirement communities or anything like that. So I think that would be the next push for the next 5 years, is to have more options for retirement and continuing care facilities that are more welcoming for our LGBT older adults.
Mm-hmm. Bob, thank you very much for being our guest, and I hope everyone will join us again for Reaching for the Gold. We're on every other Tuesday afternoon at this time. And also turn to our Facebook page, which is Just Wanna Talk 1, www.facebookpage.com/JustWannaTalk1. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.